All right. Thank you for being here. Good to have you guys back talking about Christian nationalism. We started last week with a sort of our broad overview, and as I mentioned to everybody last week, you're on a journey with me because I'm reading and trying to understand this thing more and more. And so in some ways, you kind of have to work your way into it the way that I work my way into it, which is kind of starting very broad and working very narrow. I also just kind of mentioned last week, I mean, it's not a new concept by any means, either the whether it's coming from secular left and their understanding of Christian nationalism, or whether or not it's coming from the evangelical church and the way that that has evolved. But its modern manifestation since 2021 is, you know, probably not something that I have tracked on a daily basis. So I'm trying to get my head around, you know, kind of where the winds are within the evangelical church. So that's, you just get to walk along with me while I listen to all this stuff and read all these things over the last few weeks. But before we get into this any further, let's just open up with a word of prayer. Father, thank you for this time. I'm thankful for the men who are here wanting to understand you and your design for them individually, for us as a church, even trying to comprehend your plan for the nations and thinking about how our own nation might fit into that. We pray that you would help us to think clearly and to be able to articulate those things clearly. That's going to require your mercy, giving us the power of your Spirit, who would guide us into the truth of your word, to be our teacher this day and every day. Because we have our own tendencies to want to either gratify our flesh or build up our own pride or protect our own sense of security, to do what might be most popular or pleasing to the people around us, or simply just to want to sound sometimes like we know more than we know. I pray that you guard us from all those things. We just want to be at your feet to understand your simple truth, your simple gospel. We know it has been granted to us through our Savior and through his apostles, and you gave it to us as those who are not mighty, those who are not considered wise by the world, but in fact those who are nothing. You have called us to that calling that you might bring to nothing the things that are and exalt your wisdom. And that's what we want. We want your wisdom to overwhelm our simplicity. And we want your truth to correct our error. And we can only pray for your mercy to do that. Help us then today and every day as we pursue that goal. We ask in Christ's name, amen. All right, so I'll just say here again, by the way, I'm not the great about soliciting questions, but you're always welcome, you know, at any point if you have any questions to ask Darby, and he'll be glad to answer them. But Christian nationalism is obviously, as I said, surging, particularly in the last 3 years, for a couple of different reasons. It's really people who know this better than I do say that it has been rising for a while, partly because of the splintering of conservatism. You have had for probably the last 25 years, especially, a splintering within the conservative community. It used to be coming out of the First or Second World War, you had a concerted effort towards conservatism that aligned all groups for the most part. And, you know, people would either sort of identify with William Buckley or, you know, National Review or whatever, maybe American Enterprise Institute. But as you closed out that last century and opened up this next century, you had more and more voices who were trying to articulate conservatism. And so people had to start kind of picking, like, which strand of conservatism do I follow? And that led some people to have to articulate, well, I follow the more Christian brand. Like, my conservatism isn't just sort of secular conservatism. It is a particularly Christian conservatism. And that began to move people in the direction of political theology or civic theology and thinking through how they justify their belief in various principles. So that sort of is the long view of how we got to where we are today. We spent some time last week surveying the field of every sort of the whole spectrum of what you might think about the relationship between church and government and how that's been approached and thought of in various sectors and times around the world. Today we want to spend some time kind of talking about how Christian nationalists define themselves within that maybe a more narrow strand. And this is part of it. This is part of trying to define themselves within the movement of conservatism. There was an era, you might say, where everyone who was conservative was the same. I mean, it was like, we follow Reagan. We want to do whatever Reagan did. And almost every sort of Republican debate anyway was all about how close or far you were from Reagan. And he, for a season of time, became the gold standard. I don't know, whatever, the standard of what conservatism ought to be, mostly because of his political success, I believe, not because he had any thoroughgoing philosophy of politics or government or anything, but he just was the popular flavor of the day. But that has splintered, as I said. And on top of all of that, while that's been going on, society has actually been moving in a less conservative direction. It has taken a very hard left turn. And what was, it seemed anyway, to be more like an open dialogue format or a neutral square where ideas were entertained, moved from a sort of neutral zone to a hostile zone to a suppressive zone. I mean, we've moved all that way. You might perhaps have had some plurality of voices in the media in the 50s and 60s and 70s, but already on the campuses of our universities, that was already beginning to shut down. And of course, now we've seen in the last 10 years or so, it's completely shut down in the national media. So it's left conservatives splintered on the inside and more isolated on the outside, and pushed more and more by the left into these fields of feeling, or at least being labeled, more radical. Now, this is not anything new. As a matter of fact, it goes back, you know, at least 100 years to when the secular left wanted to label Christians as fundamentalist. Fundamentalism is a word that was born in the 1911 era, when they were publishing a series of articles that were compiled into a few books called The Fundamentals. It was the attempt by Christians, conservative Christians, to define themselves while they were observing the world moving in a modernist direction, particularly a Darwinian direction. And they wanted to define what is a Christian in this kind of environment. And so they penned these books called The Fundamentals, and they were it was largely a healthy and good movement for its first 10 years. But something after World War I changed, and fundamentalism began to be more fractious on the inside. People were more zealous to prove that they're more fundamental than someone else, and that everyone else is not fundamental. And it became a sort of a a stick that even Christians were using to beat one another over the head. And it did tend to go in a more and more radical direction, where people were writing off, they were proving their commitment to the fundamentals of Christianity by writing off anything in the world and withdrawing. It really moved to an element of withdrawal, which wasn't there before World War I. So after World War I, after everyone sort of was coming home and resettling, fundamentalism started to take these very extreme forms. And of course, it was fueled by the left during the Scopes Monkey Trial up in, is it Dayton, Tennessee? Is that right? Which was a complete distortion of what was actually taking place when they were having a trial about the teaching of evolution in schools. But the national media latched onto that and painted a caricature of what conservative Christians were and began to label all conservative Christians who believed in a traditional creationism, began to label them as fundamentalist. They were fundamentalists because they rejected, supposedly, they rejected the consensus of science and the consensus of ideas in society, and they were not really interested in learning anything. They just wanted to retreat into the darkness, which was true in some areas of fundamentalism. That was, in fact, happening. But it wasn't true of every Christian, and it wasn't true of every Christian who believed in creationism. But the label stuck, and of course, you know, ever since then, it has been a pejorative. To be called a fundamentalist is a pejorative label, and until maybe recently, where some of us are quite proud to be called fundamentalists. You know, I tell people all the time, I'm a fundamentalist. But even within evangelical circles, people, they just don't want that term, that label. But that wasn't the first time that happened. I mean, that was just like, that was the playbook. And it just got repeated more and more and more as you move through the rest of the century. As the secular left became more and more radicalized, they tried to label the Christian traditionalist or the traditional Christian as the radical. And so this manifested itself in what became known as the Christian right, and then it became the radical right, and then it became eventually what we have today, which is Christian nationalism. Now, along the way, Christians have tried to be somewhat savvy and actually kind of take on the labeling that was given to them. So when they were labeled the Christian right or the radical right, the Christians tried to recategorize themselves as the moral majority. And that was moved by Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell in the 70s and 80s to want to sort of take on what they were being pushed into. Well, the same thing is kind of happening today. People are using this term Christian nationalism to label anybody who is, in fact, a biblical Christian. And some people in the evangelical circles are saying, hey, okay, well, if that's what you want to call me, that's what I am. I am a Christian nationalist. So that's part of what's going on. And why this has taken on more and more traction in the public discourse. You'll see, you know, who is the Speaker of the House? Mike Johnson. Yes, Mike Johnson. I remember when he was first elected, several headlines, New York Times, Axios, just said Christian nationalist elected for Speaker of the House. And, you know, Mike Johnson would not fit into many people's definition, at least within the Christian world, would not fit into many people's definition of a Christian nationalist. He is a run-of-the-mill Southern Baptist evangelical. Seems to be a sincere brother, but in terms of having a thoroughgoing political philosophy that aligns with Christian nationalism, I don't see any evidence of that. And yet, that's what the left does. They want to slander and create discord by attaching all of these labels. And so, as I said, some people have decided that that's what they're going to do. We're just going to embrace it, you know, along the way. And it has taken on even more traction, I think, because people are frustrated with the secular left. They're distrusting more than ever, and rightfully so, of the media, and they're beginning to adopt the mentality, well, if they're accusing me of something, that's actually a badge of honor. And so it has almost become something that has attracted people to the label because of the way the left is using it. And of course, most notably, perhaps, are followers of Donald Trump, because he is often labeled as the head of the Christian nationalist movement. Trump probably taps into something broader than what Christian nationalists believe, this effort of the left to pin everything and anything negative on Christians, to call them fascist or nationalist or whatever it might be. Actually, as I said, it kind of provokes people in a counterintuitive way to almost want to defy whatever the media is doing. This is completely a rabbit trail, but I think that's actually what you're seeing going on in the presidential campaign right now, is what might have been a rather contentious and beleaguered primary process with a number of different candidates got short-circuited quick because the secular left decided it was going to make Donald Trump a target of all of their endeavors to fabricate all kinds of prosecutions against him. And what did it do? It solidified people around him. I mean, even people that say, I'm not even that big of a fan of the guy, I'm going to stand beside him and defend him because I see what's being done. It's so obvious what's being done. Well, that's happening on a broader scale. And so there are people who are taking a sympathetic approach to this idea of Christian nationalism because of how they hear the left using it. Whether or not they even understand it, whether or not they even comprehend everything that goes into it, they're saying, well, if that's what the left is calling me, I want to take that badge. You know, I'll stand with that group. And so all of this just kind of pushes and pushes and pushes. So you have these two things going on. On one hand, you have people who are legitimately asking questions. How do you justify a conservative view of the world? And how does a Christian fit within that? That's sort of more the, you want to say, the academic side of it. And then you have the cultural side of it, where people are being pushed in this direction by the secular left. And so out of the gate, I just have to say, I feel the sympathies of all that. Personally, I feel sympathetic watching what's happening to our nation and feeling the frustrations of, you know, how disingenuous people are. I mean, it's just over the top. People have always known that there's some untrustworthiness, but it's just like the brash, disingenuous nature of, and I know I'm in a friendly crowd, so I can throw some things out there, and you guys probably 100% agree with me. But when the president is out saying, well, if you could just give me the powers to do something at the border, you know, then I would do it. Like, do you really think people believe that? And you realize, well, they must, because he wouldn't be saying it. There's a group of people that actually believe that the poor guy has no power to do anything unless Congress gives him the power. But a lot of people look at that and they just think, really? I mean, you think we're that dumb to actually go along with something like that. And so there's just this massive distrust of the media and its narrative. And I'm sympathetic to that, but very, very much so. And when I hear the left talking about Christian nationalists, I immediately have this impulse within me that wants to defend. I want to defend those people because I know in many cases they're probably very close to where I am on many, many issues. And then you mix into that the whole sort of mantra of make America great again. Make America great again, which is obviously the slogan of Trump, but it conveys this idea of wanting to go back. Like it's nostalgic, wanting to go back to something, wanting to go back to roots and the founding that America once had a greatness that somehow we've lost. And so we've got to get back to that. That very much taps into the thinking of many Christian nationalists who essentially are trying to think through what is the nature of the founding principles of America, and were they in fact grounded in explicit or implicit Christian principles? Is America essentially a Christian nation? And how do you do political theology in general, and how does America fit within that? So anyway, that's kind of how we got to where we are. A couple people, just to quote Stephen Wolf, you know, was responding to this question about how he got into this. Stephen Wolf wrote the book entitled Christian Nationalism. And so he wrote the book on this. And he says, if they're going to call me a Christian nationalist, fine. Let me just define that. Let's do a project of retrieval and recovery, and let's say that Christian nationalism is a good thing. That was his approach. He kind of responded to the label, and he said, yeah, if that's what you're going to call me, all right, well, let's just define what that is. Doug Wilson says essentially the same thing. He says at some level, you're going to be called what your adversary calls you. And basically, I thought Christian nationalism was a big improvement over white supremacist. So I think I would agree with that. So he embraced the label in recent years for the same reason. Of course, he wrote his book before Stephen Wolf called Mere Christendom. So he was articulating these things before, but only subsequent to the whole Trump movement has he been sort of taking on the label of a Christian nationalist. So these are people who are basically saying, yeah, I am a Christian and I live in this nation, and how does that impact me and thinking through this? So as I said last week, the thing that sort of unites and centers everybody is this broad agreement among all of us that secularism doesn't work. There you cannot have a morality without an idea of transcendence. You can't. And I think that is, whether or not most Christians understand that is fundamental to Christianity. It's fundamental. You cannot have a morality without some idea of transcendence. And you can't have a nation without a morality. So those ideas are there. And I don't think that we should dispute that, because that is fundamental to our gospel message, that you can't have morality without, you can't have morality without transcendence. That's not to say that you have to be a Christian to be a moral person, because the conscience is informed by that transcendent power. Like there is a conscience in the heart of every person, and that conscience is given to them by God. And whether or not they are explicitly following a faith and a religion, if they have something of a trained and tender conscience, they will have some form of morality. In fact, everyone will have a morality to the extent that their conscience is active. So understand what I'm saying. I'm not saying that you a person won't have morals unless they're religious, but I'm saying you have no way of establishing a morality apart from something transcendent, outside of yourself. Like, we cannot have, what do we have, 6 billion people on the earth? We cannot have 6 billion moralities. You have to have one morality, and the morality has to come from outside of yourself. Otherwise, you have nothing but 6 billion moralities. So that principle is I think, founded in Christianity. And Christian nationalists, then, launching off of that, work their way back to a political philosophy that essentially tries to map all of that onto a national agenda at some point. And the question that, you know, we have to grapple with is, should we, can we, and then should we do that? Is that, as one person said, is our task as Christians irreducibly political? That's the language sometimes of Christian nationalists. Our task as Christians is irreducibly political because of those principles that I talked about, because our understanding of a nation and its connection to morality and morality's connection to the transcendent. We are Christian, therefore we derive our morality from above, and our morality plays into what we think about our nation, and so therefore we ought to be trying to make our nation Christian. That's the reasoning in a nutshell of the Christian nationalist. Now, they contrast themselves with those who are not, who are not in agreement or who don't think that way, as perhaps overly idealistic about how far you can, how much you can govern people who don't buy into that, or how much you should care about that. So in other words, they contrast themselves with the idealist or the apathetic, and they say, no, we're the ones who are really thoroughgoing in that. Isaac, you have a question?
Yeah, I'm just going to ask. So is this in regard to policy, public policy? That's what we're talking about. Is when we talk about making a nation Christian, have the cultural side and then the political, we must obey these laws. Is that what we're talking about? Is when they're saying make it a Christian nation, our policies must be oriented, or I guess I'm having a hard time understanding.
I think Doug Wilson describes it as an old town village where, you know, those are normally built on the square, and at the center of the square was the church. And so the church dominated the public square. But it didn't make all the shoes, and it didn't, you know, it wasn't the ironsmith. And it wasn't the bakery. It didn't do everything in society. So this is not saying that you have sort of the priesthood running the nation, but that everyone understands that all the conversation in the public square is done within the shadow of the church. That's his image of how all this operates. So it's, for him, it's cultural. Now, that's not true for other people. For other people, it is more explicitly, I think this is where Stephen Wolfe is, it's more explicitly policy related. That you can't have public policy that doesn't stand on morality, and morality, you can't have morality that doesn't stand on something to do, or he would actually, he's more focused on American history. You can't have a consistent American policy if you don't have it founded on our documents, and our documents, he would say, are explicitly Christian. Yes, Quentin?
I think it's so much Christian or moral.
Well, they're saying you can't separate them.
I agree. When you talk to people about Christianity, there's a resistance, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had this discussion. discussion. And I keep saying, well, we have a moral government. And a lot of times the founders talked about a moral government without tagging on Christian connection.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree that morality comes from our faith. I don't know where else it can come from. But doing the right thing is morally driven. I know it's a we're splitting hairs here.
Well, what you're probably wrestling through is trying to understand what's different today than 1776. And these guys would say in 1776, particularly coming out of the Great Awakening, you had borrowed moral capital. Whether or not the founders themselves were Christians, they were all in a church. You know, they all had some sort of association with a Christian worldview that dominated the world around them. And so they were living on borrowed capital, and they were thinking out of a Christian context when they were formulating the documents. And so this is, you know, the Christian nationalist approach is that whether or not, you know, they weren't founding a Christian nation, but they were founding a nation that was built on Christian notions, because they were inseparable from the ethos around them. And America existed in its first 150 or perhaps 200 years. It existed on the remaining fumes of that Christian ethos, but it's running out of gas. Like people started to decouple and separate from that somewhere in the 19th century with the rise of modernism, and now we're kind of like going full steam into this decoupling. So the thing I think you're wrestling with, is it Christian or is it moral, was not something that I think people thought about or even could have thought about at the founding. That's what the Christian nationalists would say. Whereas now, they're forced to think about it. Can you have a morality that is not Christian? And so that's kind of where we are in this. Now, I told you last week was like broad. Today is I am trying to define Christian nationalism. All right? I'm just trying to help you understand from their perspective what they believe. And then we're going to spend some time in the coming weeks to talk about, or at least tell you what I think about all this, you know, where I stand. And I'll go ahead and full disclosure, I'm not a Christian nationalist. So you probably should know, as I am trying to articulate the position of a Christian nationalist today, I am trying my best in all fairness to articulate these guys, but I don't necessarily think the same way they do, all right? So don't misunderstand anything that I'm saying today. So there are differences, as I was saying, within Christian nationalists on a number of different fronts. Some Christian nationalists are theonomist or postmillennialist. They have a particular view of eschatology that feeds into their view of Christian nationalist. Some are not explicitly postmillennial. I don't think Stephen Wolfe considers himself a postmillennialist. Some want a more focused attention on being thoroughgoing at every level of policy and letting that be governed by their Christian ideals. That would be the Stephen Wolfes of the world. Some, like Doug Wilson, are not. Doug Wilson would not want to, for example, have blasphemy laws. Whereas I think Stephen Wolfe supports blasphemy laws because he thinks, well, if you are saying that this is all founded on Christian idealism, then you've got to prosecute people who attack the foundation, and the attack on the foundation would be blasphemy. So he looks in the scripture and sees how they deal with blasphemers by the death penalty. or exile, and he would have blasphemy laws. Doug Wilson's worried to some extent about the curtailment of essentially free speech, freedom of expression, and having someone be labeled as a blasphemer maybe too quickly. So Wolf wants to have policies that are aligned pretty radically with the Old Testament. Doug Wilson, not as much, but he does want at every level an acknowledgement that we are explicitly Christian and that we ought to be Christian in the broad sense of the word. Not necessarily Presbyterian, he would say, but Christian. In fact, his book, Christendom, Mere Christendom, he's calling for Christendom 2.0. He actually feels like the pitfall of Christendom 1.0, which, you know, comes out of the Middle Ages and even into the magisterial reformers, Calvin, Luther, and Zwingli, he actually feels like their pitfall was that they divided denominationally, they divided amongst themselves and weakened themselves. So he's trying to recast a new Christendom, a new Christendom that understands the pitfalls of the first Christendom and doesn't splinter in that way. So that's why he's not wanting to have as much curtailment of freedom of speech. So Stephen Wolfe, as I said, who wrote the book on Christian nationalism, defines Christian nationalism as a totality of national action consisting of civil laws and social customs conducted by a Christian nation as a Christian nation in order to procure for itself both earthly and heavenly good in Christ. There's a lot in there. It's well thought out in terms of where he comes from. But the thing that strikes many people in that definition is the word totality. A totality of national action consisting of civil laws and social customs conducted by a Christian nation as a Christian nation. So he's basically saying, thinking about what it is to be a Christian nation at every conceivable level, top to bottom, in total, so that everything you do as a nation, since we are a Christian nation, that's his first assumption, we should operate as a Christian nation. And as a Christian nation, since we profess that the best total good that can come to a person comes from the Christian ideals, we should therefore require all people to operate by Christian ideals. Yes. Is it Jonathan?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it sounds like to me that they are just ignoring the fact that the millennium will be that way. And I'm assuming that most of these are people who do not believe in the millennium at all.
We're going to get to I'm going to end up in just a minute there, but basically, yes. Maybe we can kind of just delve into that, because that does drive particularly Doug Wilson. I think Stephen Wolfe would actually say that your eschatology is not a factor. And does he really talk about eschatology in his book?
Talks about how he's amillennial, and he talks explicitly about how what he's trying to propose is all this worldly,
mm-hmm.
and that the coming kingdom is, we can never do anything to bring that about.
Yeah, that's my understanding, that he tries to diminish the role of eschatology, whereas Doug Wilson says, no, it is very much a factor, because he says, if you are what he labels a pessimistic amillennialist, which he thinks most amillennials are pessimistic, or a pessimistic premillennialist, because he thinks all premillennialists are by definition pessimistic. We all just moan at the world getting worse, but we don't want to do anything about it. He said that you're going to have a propensity to just accept the slide around you and not do anything. So in his mind, the thing that drives optimism and hope to want to reform a nation is his postmillennial view. So he would say that you have to have a hope of a Christian kingdom to want to engage in this kind of an enterprise, because it's massive and it takes a long time. It's not going to happen in 10 years. It's going to be like a very slow climb up a hill, and, you know, not like a rocket ship, he says. So to some extent, you have to kind of, I actually think there's a reality to that. There's a reality to what he's saying. And I think you can trace it out historically. I'm sorry, Quentin, I'm going to follow this thought through a little bit. So historically, amillennialism is the view that there is no millennium. The letter A, sometimes called the alpha privative, it negates a word. So when you put it on the front, it basically means no millennium. There is no thousand-year kingdom that's in store. That position was really birthed out of Augustine in the year 430 in his book, City of God. Prior to him, you had premillennialism virtually universal in the church. That's all you had. It's known as historic premillennialism. The view of the church before Augustine was 100%, I think it's safe to say. Origen, some people question whether Origen would fit into that. But apart from Origen, you had virtually everybody believed in premillennialism, that there was going to be a thousand-year kingdom that was coming at some point in the future. Augustine, I mentioned this a little bit last week, responded to what he saw had been corruption in the church by saying that the kingdom is not material, it's not of this world, and we shouldn't, you know, try to think of it in this world. We should think of it as purely spiritual. So he decoupled the idea of a reign of Christ from anything material in this world, political in this world, whatever. And he created this notion of two cities of God, or two cities, the city of God and the city of the world. I guess it would be the other side of that. So that became the dominant view of the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church is amillennial to this day. And it is, because of Augustine's articulation, it is embedded, people would say, that you don't care about the city of this world. Like, you only care about the city of God, which is non-material, only spiritual, and all those ways. So people like Doug Wilson would say that is essentially pessimistic. Like, essentially, you are throwing up your hands, you're abandoning this world, the city of this world, and you're only concerned about the spiritual realities which exist within the church. That view, as I said, dominated all the way up, really, until Puritanism and the rise of the Puritans, beginning in England and then certainly in America. Puritans started to question that whole eschatology. They were questioning, along with other reformers, everything from the Catholic Church. And they questioned the eschatology of the Catholic Church, whether or not you should have any kind of notion of building in a material way a Christian kingdom. And you had what is known as Puritan millenarianism that was born out of that. Now, there's a lot of fluidity in Puritan millenarianism, but if you go back to Oliver Cromwell, who was the sort of champion of the English Puritans in 1555, I think it is. He actually, Cromwell wanted to see Israel restored as a nation, because he understood that that needed to happen before Christ could come back. He actually chartered three ships to send Jews from England back to Israel. That was a part of his millenarian view. So they were working through this view of how do we usher in the kingdom of God? How do we facilitate it? And it went beyond not only repatriation of Jews back to Israel, but it also went into how do we prepare the land that we live in England, and then eventually in America. In America, in was it 16? When did the Plymouth Brethren land? You know, Quentin, I had this written down somewhere in here. 1620. That's right. So 1620 was Plymouth Brethren, 1630 Massachusetts Bay, and then on into the second, the rest of the 1600s, you had the founding of Connecticut, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, all as essentially Puritan territories. All of them had, and their founding documents, explicitly Puritan language. And they were founding a new world, that they were thinking from the ground up what it should look like. It wasn't a redeemed old world, which you had in England. It was a new world. And so how do you think about a brand new colony from the ground up? And this kind of came infused with their Puritan millenarianism. And it developed into a broad post-millennial view among Puritans. Most Puritans that you read, particularly in the 18th and 18th century, I guess you would say, those Puritans are going to be 90% post-millennial, because they were trying to think through, we're not Catholic, we're something else, and we are on the cusp of a whole new society. How do we do all that? And so we moved in the direction away from amillennialism, which they articulated as being too disconnected from the material elements of society. And they wanted something that touched every element of society. They became optimistic about what the world could be and what the new world was. And this optimism, you know, fueled a kind of a post-millennial view. But obviously, that experiment failed. I think it's safe to say that experiment failed. They had full control, 100% control from the beginning to establish a new world under these Christian principles and to usher in the kingdom. And with all of that, we have where we stand today. We have the church where we stand today. It is the grandest illustration, I think, of the deficiency of a post-millennial theology. I'm throwing these terms out. I'm hoping that you guys, I probably should define. So amillennialism basically does not believe there's any kingdom coming. Post-millennialism believes that there is a kingdom in the future that is going to be explicitly Christian and under Christ, but that it is our job to establish that kingdom as a church by basically bringing Christ's rule into every area of society. And when we do that, Christ will return to reign at that point. Premillennialism actually says that none of those areas will be brought under Christ until after Christ returns. In other words, Christ must come before the millennium. It must be pre. So premillennialism looks at the world continuing on a particular course, and then at some point Christ returns and he establishes a 1,000-year millennial kingdom. So those are your three basic views of eschatology, and this does play into this to some extent. So Doug Wilson would say the amillennialist is basically pessimistic. He doesn't look at any role of Christ's kingdom in the material world. The premillennialist is necessarily pessimistic. He just thinks, you know, the world is going to go to hell in a handbasket, and you know, I'm just going to have my Christian school and my, you know, Christian potluck over here until it happens. And the postmillennialist is the only one who actually thinks that you should engage in the world. And so that is essential to his view of Christian nationalism. But as Darby was saying, Stephen Wolfe doesn't think so. He actually thinks that this is just an exercise in political philosophy. How do you justify your conservatism? So Wilson, I'll end on this. Wilson would say that people like you and me have embraced loser theology. That's what we have. We have loser theology. We have a theology that informs and instructs us that we're supposed to lose. And so what do? It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Since we have told ourselves theologically that we're supposed to lose, then when the left strikes out against us, our natural response is, thank you, sir, may I have another? That's just the way we are. Now, I don't think that's true, but that's the way that Doug Wilson frames it, and it has caught the attention of a lot of people, because they think they've bought into the notion that they don't want loser theology.
Is that what he thinks?
Doug Wilson? Yeah, he thinks that people like me have loser theology. Oh, he thinks he's a postmillennialist. So
he, yeah,
yeah. No, he's a postmillennialist, so he has winning theology. He thinks you ought to go out there and win the world. But traditional Baptist premillennialist, he would say, have loser theology. Well, he is selling books. But he's also tapping into strains that resonate with Trumpism. That, you know, who else is out there saying, are you tired of losing? Remember this famous speech by Trump? If you elect me, you're going to be tired of winning. In fact, I saw the other day, I'd forgotten about this. It was a Saturday Night Live skit. They actually made a Saturday Night Live skit before Trump was elected. And supposedly, this was 2 years into his presidency. And they were trying to figure out what to do since they were winning so much. Because this was his thing in 2016. Are you tired of losing? When you elect me, you'll be tired of winning. I mean, that just goes straight in line with Doug Wilson. And so you can see why many people have connected Christian nationalism with Trumpism. Or reverse that around, the frustrations that in some ways explain why so many Christians would give their right arm to support a man like Trump. The frustrations that explain that are in some ways the same frustrations that explain the popularity of Christian nationalism. So what I want to do, I really haven't even defined Christian nationalism today like I wanted to, but we'll come back and talk a little bit more about that. And then I want to kind of then really kind of dive into this idea, like, are we losers? And how should we think about this? I mean, how do we think about moral theology? And really what I wanted to do today, and we'll get into it next time, is I want to kind of go back to the pre-Augustinian world. And let's just start by thinking from a historical project. How did those guys, who were all premillennialists, live in a pagan society? And in fact, a pagan society that became, at least at a political level, a Christian society. How did they do that? And how could that inform us? And then after that sort of historical exercise, we're actually going to get into sort of a biblical view of the of what the apostles had to say about some of these things, and then try to start thinking about some of the implications for us as Christians. So that'll take us still a few more weeks to kind of work through all that. Any closing questions? Yes,
maybe,
Jesse.
Maybe what you just said will talk down
again. I'm sorry, I called you Jesse. I saw you, and I called you Jesse Clay.
Yeah.
Yes.
But when you said like Creed, Augustine, pretty much all premillennial. I feel like anytime you read like an all mill, they'll claim the opposite. And when you read a premill, they claim the opposite.
Well,
do you think that that could be something you maybe could elaborate on a little bit more next week? I feel like anytime I read them, it's like, oh, the premillennial.
They would say dispensationalism is the new thing, which, you know, I would agree. There were no dispensationalists in the early church. They were anti-Semitic. They were not hoping for Israel to be a part of that kingdom. If they're saying that, then they're true. That's true. But if they're saying that the early fathers did not believe in a thousand-year millennial kingdom, that's just bogus. I don't know what else to do. I could bring you six or eight quotes from early church fathers talking about a millennial kingdom, if that might help. So we can try to retrace that some, or it'd be better if you had some quotes that I could even respond to, perhaps. Yeah. 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 Jonathan?
The only thing I would say is that I would be curious to find out where is God's sovereignty within these different pieces to you, whether it's Stephen Wolf or Doug Wilson and those kind of things. Do they all have a similar view?
You can only talk about election when it comes to your individual salvation. You cannot talk about election when it comes to eschatology. That's out of bounds. At least according to Doug Wilson. Because those of us who actually believe Israel is elect, I think are the most consistent Calvinist. But anyway, that's I'm being facetious. That's a big question. That's a big question that we have to think about.